Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
We want to, first of all, welcome you all, and especially thank Firehouse.com for partnering with the United States Fire Administration and enabling this safety roundtable to take place. Not only are we going to have a roundtable, but this will also be blogged at Firehouse.com and also Twittered by both the U.S. Fire Administration and Firehouse. And finally, this session will be taped and will be podcast later today at Firehouse.com for those that are unable to participate live with us during this hour. We especially want to thank our participants, some of whom are at our roundtable here, and others who are with us virtually through a FEMA teleconference line, thanks to this new world of social networking. Joining us on this blog are Fire Chief Robert Dubay of the IFC Safety, Health, and Survival Section, Assistant Chief Billy Goldfeder, the chairman of that section, both Rich Duffy and Jim Brinkley from the International Association of Firefighters, Ron Sarnecki, the Executive Director of the National Fallen Firefighters, and also from the NFFF, John Pearls. We have Phil Stittleberg from the National Volunteer Fire Council with us. And here at the United States Fire Administration, we have Bert Clark and Bill Troop of our staff. But most important of all, we have Susie Nichols of Firehouse.com, who is actually doing the blogging for us today. So with that, Susie, why don't you go ahead with the first question?
Okay, we received several questions online. One of the first ones we'll get right to it is, what do you see as the single biggest obstacle in improving firefighter safety and health?
Let's throw that one out to Ron Sarnecki first. Ron, you want to take a crack at that one?
Ron? Sure, Al. Thanks for inviting us to participate. As we move this to prepare for the stand down, the piece that has come out through the life safety initiatives and the efforts of the Everyone Goes Home campaign is really to get firefighters to focus on the fact that these accidents, injuries, and deaths can't happen to them. And there are times when people make decisions and take steps that are related to excessive risk and feel that that they are doing what they think is needed to be done, but unfortunately put themselves in significant harm's way from the standpoint of that their culture, their beliefs are that they've got to get it. Don't realize that it can affect them.
Dr. Clark, do you want to add anything to that?
Thank you very much. I would just reiterate what Chief Sarnecki said. When you read the NIOSH LODD line of duty death reports, there are really no new surprises in terms of how firefighters are injured and killed. And in most situations, we know the correct way to do things. Our challenge is to make sure we do our job 100% correct 100% of the time. So a 200% proficiency level is very challenging, and I think we're the only occupation that requires that level of performance. But by not striving for that, the results are devastating. So we need to do a better job of what we already know how to do.
Phil, you want to kind of give us the perspective from NVFC on that one?
Well, I think Dr. Clark says it extremely well. He says that there's no surprise in how our people are continuing to die, and I think that that's just an excellent point to keep in mind. If we know why people are getting injured and we know people are dying and we've known that for a long time, how come we haven't fixed it? And it seems to me that both Ron Sarnecki and Dr. Clark have touched on it, and it is a cultural situation. I think it is solved in two ways. First of all, it is solved through training and changing attitudes. I think it has to be absolutely ingrained in people that safety is priority one, and we unfortunately haven't been able to achieve that. And that's the second thing, and I think this gets overlooked sometimes, is the importance of leading by example. Don't be expecting your people to use their seat belts if you don't buckle up. Don't expect people to be safe on the fire ground if you're not conducting yourself safely.
Great. Before we welcome Glenn Gaines, who has just been able to make it, I think it might be good if, Rich, do you want to weigh in on that one and give us the perspective from the International Association of Firefighters? Rich Duffy? Or Jim Brinkley? Sounds like they might have dropped off. Well, with that, I'm going to move out of the chair, and Chief Gaines, the acting U.S. Fire Administrator, is going to take the seat here and go ahead and complete the tasks at hand. Susie, do you have the next question?
Yes. It concerns size up, or actually the lack thereof. And what do you think about adding a fourth benchmark to the size up complete so everyone on the fire ground knows that the initial tactics were based off of complete size up has been completed?
Glenn, who would you like to take that call?
Let's try Bob right here. Bob, you want to?
I think that adding that to NIMS, that's a whole other arena, but certainly having a size up specific focus on training, that would back up and go to the unit officers that we can train them to do their jobs better, and certainly they'd make their firefighters better. I think I'd pass that off to Mr. Troop about the NIMS question, but going back to the first question, it kind of ties that together. But if you look at the company officer at that level, that's the person that's going to make a difference in how these firefighters are going into places where they shouldn't or doing things that they shouldn't. That's the person that's got to lead them, and that's the only one that's going to make it work.
By the way, folks, I disconnected myself, but this is Rich Duffy and Jim Franklin. We're back.
Hi, Rich. Glenn Gaines, did you want to talk a moment about the earlier question, which was?
It's about adding size up to NIMS and, so everybody on the fire ground also knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah, Rich, the issue had to do with adding size up as a, as a subject matter piece in terms of the NIMS component.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, going back to the first question, which I apologize for disconnecting myself, I think it's important to realize that we can point a lot of fingers and make a lot of blame, but the reality is why we still have firefighters killed and injured and become sick from their job has to do with the not just the philosophy of firefighting or safety issue, but the lack of lots of things, the lack of resources, lack of proper staffing, lack of protective equipment, and more so, which we're seeing clearly in this day economy, reduction in training of firefighters. We can blame it on lots of other things, but the reality of properly resourced fire departments is a safer fire department, very clearly. And on the size up issue, sure. I mean, that's part of everyday training of firefighters, and just an excuse when people run into the building without proper resources already on scene or without proper command, regardless of the size fire or the emergency, sitting back, knowing where you are, knowing what you need to commit, knowing what you do keeps people safe.
Yeah, Rich, Glenn Gaines again. I'm just reminded that the number one cause of near-miss reports is such lack of situational awareness, which plays right into the size-up issue. So let's go to the next.
Glenn, on that issue, I'll be brief. For years I've been arguing about putting breathing apparatus back into compartments where they belong instead of in these quick eject seats or whatever they're used in inside crew cabins or in the front seats. But the issue we've always said is that gives an opportunity not only for people to get off the truck and don the equipment from the cabinets, but that 30 seconds or 45 seconds that takes doesn't delay the response. I think it enhances the response, so everybody has an idea where they're going, and the officer or officers have an opportunity to make decisions on how to proceed. We lose that when people go jumping out of a jump seat and running into a building.
Well, let me add to that, if I may. This is Billy.
Sure, go ahead, Bill.
You can't, and obviously we're speaking to our audience, and first of all, what Rich said is absolutely correct. You got to take a minute and look, and if that means we mechanically have to make a change to equipment in order to force that to happen, then so be it. But there's really two parts of size up. There's what do we have when we get there, which must include, to add to Susie's comment, you can't operate at any emergency without size up. It just depends on what level we're going to size up. And specifically to the one fire that seems to be getting us the most, and that's a single-family dwelling. You absolutely must do a walk-around. How can you possibly go in? It's like going in to play a football game and not even looking at the field before you jump in the middle of it. Only there's obviously a big difference. But the other side of size up one, size up part one is what do we have? Size up part two is what do we have to deal with what we have, which ties into what Rich said. If you pull up to a, let's just say a 3,000 square foot single family dwelling, a lightweight wood truss two story with a basement, you've got good fire in a number two floor or the division two on side alpha, let's say, and you've only pulled up with five people, you can't do what's necessary immediately for that fire. Unless mom's screaming, the babies are in there. That's, you know, rescue is not necessarily your first priority. And your best priority is to get water on the fire. But when you pull up and there's only five firefighters, and that's it, and you've not taken advantage of automatic mutual aid, or your city has so brutally cut your budget that you don't have the staffing to do it, you've got to understand, we've got to understand, and more importantly, our communities have to understand, we can't do what you expect us to do. We can't do what they do on Rescue Me. We can't do what they see on Backdraft, on the images that the public has. And even looking at some books my grandson has, it shows 7, 8, 9 firefighters on an engine racing to a fire. That's the image the public has. That's not what we're delivering in many cases. So really, looking at size up and then tying into Susie's question, hell yeah, we have to do size up. But more importantly, when we do the size up, determining what do we have, where is the fire, where was it, where's it going, part two is, do we have the resources to deal with that problem? If not, what can we do the best with what we have to work with?
Good. Thank you, Bill. Some important points made. Susie, we have
another question that came up, and this came up quite a few times, about the economy and fire safety. Do you see any, you know, things being curtailed due to the budget cuts?
All right, Rich, why don't you take that one on? I know the union, you're probably hearing every day about the loss of firefighter positions and certainly the effect of the economy. So why don't you kick off and take the lead on that question?
Well, I mean, obviously the economy is going to have a significant impact on fire department staffing as we're seeing layoffs continuing around the country, which puts not only firefighters at risk, but our communities at risk. Hopefully, fire departments will make themselves available of other tools. I mean, I think training is another issue we're seeing significantly reduced in fire departments because they don't want to pay out for training. The philosophy there is they'd rather keep the lights on in firehouse, which, again, there's value in that for the community and firefighter risk, but taking people out of training puts firefighters at an even greater risk on a day-to-day basis. Additionally, there are resources out there. For example, we still talk about the largest killer of firefighters, and we can debate that all day, but we'll take that on what it is, that half the fatalities are heart-related fatalities, and the vast majority of fire departments in this country haven't even bothered not only to adopt or implement a wellness fitness program, but haven't even bothered even to read it and find the tools that we've put in together with the fire chiefs, where we've actually shown saving fire departments money, significant amounts of money. We have examples on our website of fire departments that save 10 times of their investment in continuous savings in a reduction of injuries and work comp costs by simply adopting a program. And I think fire service individuals and fire officers around the country have no right talking about heart disease and what we need to do about it until we implement a wellness fitness program. So that the economy may be an excuse for memory issues, but when we demonstrate that money is saved, and likewise, I mean, a fully resourced fire department saves the community significant money in fire loss costs and insurance costs, and I think we need to go back and dwell on that. It's not just turning lights off. It's putting people at risk, putting financial resources at risk, and putting, most importantly, firefighters at risk.
Good point. Thanks, Rich. I wanted to ask Phil to take just a moment and talk about the economy and how it affects volunteer departments across the country. I know that many of them exist solely on donations, and certainly that piece of donation money in the local budget. By that, I mean family budgets have been suppressed. Can you spend just a moment and talk about that? And if you have any ideas in terms of how our listeners could implement strategies to deal with that issue.
Well, you're absolutely correct. The downturn in the economy is a problem for the Volunteer Fire Service, actually for two reasons. One, you already touched on, that is the fact that people that financially support volunteer fire departments, and people that are donors and also people that are taxpayers, have less money to spend. And consequently, that means there's less money available for the fire department. And that means the fire department either is going to have less resources than it needs, or it's going to spend more time fundraising, which takes away from time they should be doing other things, or both. So the decrease in the money is one challenge. But an additional challenge, of course, is the impact on personnel. The Volunteer Fire Service thrives on a stable economy. A contracting economy, an economy that's in recession, means that people are getting laid off and they're moving elsewhere to take different jobs. It means that people are working two jobs because they're having trouble making ends meet. And all that cuts into their discretionary time to volunteer the time to the department, which really leads us back to the earlier question about matching your resources to the needs of the particular call. In terms of what can you do about it, the NVSC has a program called Fire Corps, which IFF and IFC are also involved in. And what that program does is encourages the general public to engage in non-operational roles for the fire department. In other words, things like bookkeeping and accounting and public ed and inspections, anything else that they're willing to do to free the firefighters' time up so they can spend more time on their training and emergency response. So a downturn in the economy forces us to be more creative in figuring out how we get the work done in a volunteer department.
All right, thank you. Bill Troop of our staff would like to make a couple comments in terms of this particular subject.
Thank you, Chief Gaines. In light of the tough economy and the impact on the fire service and EMS, the U.S. Fire Administration, in partnership with the Department of Homeland Security, also Health Affairs, we're going to be working to update the existing USFA guide to funding alternatives for emergency services, which will provide information to local level fire departments about grant funding, alternative funding sources, and again, to provide needed guides updating our decade-old document.
All right, thank you. A couple of personal notes. Having been a fire chief in Fairfax County, Virginia, I know that the two areas most generally we'll see first cut by municipalities is administrative support, including all health-related issues for firefighters. The physicals, money for physicals, tend to be some of the first cuts that are made. Certainly fire prevention, public education, and enforcement of building codes tend to take a quick hit. So all of these issues certainly are a challenge, I know, to our listeners. And if any of you out there have ideas in terms of how fire departments should and can deal with this successfully, if you have model programs or initiatives that have been taken on, we at USFA would like to know about them and would make sure that we get those on our website out to our constituents. So, Susie, you on. Give us the next question.
Okay, I have a question here that I don't know if anyone has. You certainly can comment on this. If firefighter safety is such an issue, why can't we get the Sweet 16, the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation Life Safety Initiatives, published in any standard firefighting textbooks? Anybody, it's supposed to be incorporated to all of the training, but it's not in any of the textbooks.
Ron, you want to jump on that one for us? Certainly a subject that's near and dear to your heart.
Absolutely, and what I've got to say is that we have actually been talking with the publishers about that very issue. We have talked to Fire Protection Publications about, for example, the Essentials book. We've talked to each of the publishers as they go through rewrites and as they go through re-releases of their basic training manuals and their textbooks. they have made a commitment to add it to it, but it's a multi-year cycle. The other thing is through the Assistance to Firefighter Grant Program, the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation has been working with FESCI to develop college-level training course, which will be added to the fire science curriculum through FESCI and the United States Fire Administration. And we are producing a textbook on the complete 16 initiatives that could be used for classroom settings for college education at both the associate's and bachelor's level. We're hoping is that document made available, students will be able to pick it up and use it for promotional processes and educational and training components related to firefighter safety and survivability.
All right, thanks, Ron. Good words. We're going to throw it back to Susie for another question. Unless anyone else has some ideas there, does anyone else want to capture the mic? And if you have an idea in terms of the 16 initiatives, I should note that we have included those in our strategic plan that we're developing here at USFA in partnership with the National Fallen Firefighters. I guess as most of you know, we host the National Fallen Firefighters National Fallen Firefighters Foundation here at USFA. And so we listen very closely to Ron as he walks around the campus. So, Susie, I want to throw it to you.
Yeah, there are quite a few questions on the have been submitted about firefighter visits and the high cost. And is there any organizations out there trying to get someone to participate to give firefighter rescue personnel free physicals? And should be, and more importantly, should they be mandatory for people who are participating in the business?
All right. I'm going to throw that to Bob Dubé of IFC. And then, Rich, I know that you have to sign off, and I know this is something that's important to the union and actually to all firefighters. If you look at the numbers, the high rate of heart attacks that are experienced by firefighters, and certainly the cancer rates, I know that's a rather controversial subject, but certainly one that the exposures that firefighters face each day, it's a subject that I'm glad we received the question regarding this particular subject, because it is something that not only fire service leaders, but certainly individual firefighters should be aware of. So, Robert, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, one of the goals we have in our 2009-2010 strategic plan for IFC, safety, health, and survival, is to do that very thing, to work out a way to get a NFPA-compliant physical to all active firefighters in North America. Billy might have some new updates on this, but we have started discussions through physicians that are members of our section with the American Medical Association to try to figure out a way to do just that. The other thing to think about at the local level is most people have a health care plan, and most of those health care plans will give you a physical. Now, it might not be an NFPA-compliant physical, but at least you can get something. But I know Billy might have a little update on that, but I know we've just started in the last 2 months with going towards that funding and the AMA to try to work a partnership to get that done. But there's also the firefighter grant funds that can do physicals for entry level and then current firefighters as well.
Let me go ahead and yield to Rich Duffy if Rich has got to go, and then I can add on. Also, if one of us is on a cell phone outside, it's picking up the wind. Go ahead, Rich.
Sure. First of all, this is not something that's a couple months old. We came out with the Wellness Fitness Initiative back in 1996, so if my addition is right, about 13 years ago, and which requires a mandatory annual physical evaluation. A number of fire departments are obviously doing that. The NFPA 1582 standard mirrors exactly the Wellness Fitness Initiative, so those fire departments don't want to adopt something that says IFF, IFC, only get an NFPA, and they're getting the same thing. There is no excuse out there for not to give an annual physical to firefighters, both in career fire departments and volunteer fire departments. And, in fact, it's a law. So most of these fire departments that aren't doing it right now are clearly in violation. If they're either under federal OSHA jurisdiction or a state plan state or another state that has their own health and safety requirements, which most of them do. So it is just continually jurisdictions keeping their head in the sand, ignoring the issue, and when, in fact, they have a legal, moral, and regulatory responsibility to provide these medical. So we think that everybody should participate. We've said that since 1976 when the Wellness Initiative Wellness Fitness Initiative began, and we hold true to that today. You know, back in December of 1980s when Federal OSHA signed the first standard that dealt with firefighters, the Fire Brigade Standard. Again, it wasn't very long. It wasn't very detailed. Then the fire service jumped up and down. And they jumped down for the content. They jumped up and down because people finally direct them to do something. And again, we've attempted to do our best to implement it. It's not impossible to pay for. It's not impossible to schedule. New York City Fire Department can have annual medicals for all their members and have done so since over 10 years now, then no fire department has an excuse how large or small for scheduling process for costs. Again, go to our website on the Wellness Fitness Initiative. The implementation section of that details many cities that have shown not only is it cost effective, there's significant dollars back for every dollar invested in the program. So it's clearly a cost saving. The problem we have is jurisdictions have multiple budget lines, and the fire department budget line and the work comp line aren't necessarily the same one. So what we see is that even though there's a significant savings in the work comp line, that doesn't bounce back and reflect the fire department budget.
Thank you, Rich. I come from a department that about 96% of the Wellness Fitness Initiative we were able to implement. We dropped disability retirements by 72% over a three-year period. I think you could certainly look at Fairfax as one, and I know that Phoenix, Indianapolis, and others have nearly implemented the Wellness Fitness Initiative recommendations. It's tough. It's a tough sell. Billy, I want to throw it back to you, and then Phil, I want you to think about, I know your constituents, very difficult issue for you to address given the cost, but I want you to think about what you might want to say to our listeners in terms of the protecting the volunteer firefighters who serve their departments. So, Bill, I want to throw it to you for a comment.
It really, what we're trying to do at the IFC, and actually within the last 30 days or so, we've really cranked up some energy, and there's significant interest in our board of directors at the IFC on this issue. And what we want to try and do is eliminate the excuse. In other words, what Rich said, and I'm sure what Phil is going to say, it's such a local issue if a department can afford, they can't afford it. They want to do it. They want to make it mandatory. They don't want to make it mandatory, and all the other reasons that are given. But what we're going to try and do is identify fire departments that just do not have the money for it, whether it be career, volunteer, part-time, whatever they are. And we're working right now. We've got several doctors involved, and we did this specifically because we need to be able to speak their language, and working with the AMA to see if we can offer a free physical to any firefighter that can prove they have no other way to get it. So that's one of, as Chief Dubay, Bob Dubay said, if you go to ifcsafety.org and you click on our 2009 strategic plan, it will identify you in there that is one of the goals, and we're getting ready to put some significant energy into that, and we anticipate working with the IFF, getting their input in the NVFC and anybody else we need to eliminate the excuse. But once we do that, and as Rich Duffy said before, there's plenty of departments that have the opportunity to provide physicals, and either it's not mandatory, firefighters are not going for them. And when it's the firefighter not going for it, it's a real selfish issue that you're not considering not only yourself and getting yourself in trouble while operating on a run, but also what you're doing to your family. When you've got a 5'4", 350-pound firefighter, it's pretty predictable what's going to happen, and something needs to be done about that.
Thank you. Bill, do you want to say a couple words about the challenges that our volunteer firefighters and fire chiefs face on this issue?
Yes, I think there are really two issues there. One, Billy already touched on, that's the dollars. And Billy says, yeah, let's remove the excuse. And that's great if we can find a way to fund everybody getting physicals, but at least as it stands right now, I don't view that as being used as an excuse. I view lack of dollars being viewed simply as a fact of life for an awful lot of people. In a perfect world, we'd all have the physicals, and that would be a very good thing. But they are expensive. we need to look at doing what we can. It's already been mentioned about a lot of people's health insurance will include annual physical, that although it may not be an NFPA compliant physical, at least it's a start, and that's helpful. Tracking vitals and that sort of thing through your local EMS may be a start. Contacting your local hospital to see if they're willing to donate at least some portion of a physical is a start. So there are ways, although they may not be the full answer, but there are ways to deal with the expense of it. And I'm real interested to hear the IASC program, and if they're able to put together what Billy's describing, I think that's a wonderful thing. However, I mentioned there are really two issues here, and one we focused on, that's the fact that it's expensive, but the other you have to focus on is the perception that this may cause me to lose my job. And that's an important perception, whether it's a paid person or whether it's a volunteer person. Physicals frequently are regarded not as something for your good, but as something that may serve to put you out of the service. And we need to overcome that by being able to demonstrate that, first of all, in most instances, that's not the case. And second of all, in those instances where that is the case, we're probably saving that person's life by having discovered the condition that should put them out of service.
Well, that's a real battle that has to be fought. One of the negotiations that we undertook with the union in our department was to offer 15 light-duty positions that actually was agreed upon, along with a reduction in the percentage paid out to workers' comp retirement, so that the employee had an option of either taking a light-duty position or opting for the workers' comp amount. I'm going to throw it back to Susie for another question.
Okay, this just came in a couple minutes ago. Because how do we get chiefs have done it this way, and firefighter survival and all this is hogwash, and do you think NFPA 1407, once it's final, will help some of these departments change that mindset?
Yeah, I'm going to need some help on 1407. I am not familiar with that.
You mean 1403 live fire training?
Would it be 1403? We're not sure. Anybody familiar with 1407 on the line? All right. Well,
basically, I still think they're asking how do you get a chief officer who, you know, isn't really sold on this firefighter fitness and survival, you know, how do you change the culture?
1407 is rapid intervention.
Yeah, I have so written.
Okay. All right, good. Let's see. Phil, you want to try that one? And then, you know, I guess the question is raised from someone who's further down the corporate ladder. So how do we work bottom up? Of course, there are several avenues, but I'd be interested, Phil. Why don't you chime in that? And then, Rich, I know you have to leave, or have you left? Rich, are you still online? Okay, so we'll go. Let's go with Phil for now.
Okay. I guess you can't ask a much more basic question than how do you change a facet of culture in the fire service. It gets right down to the absolute core, because I think that safety or a lack of regard for safety is indeed a cultural issue. So, you know, how do you change the culture in that regard, particularly if you're trying to change it from the bottom up? Well, one thing that the volunteer fire service, I think, has that perhaps is an advantage that the paid sector may not enjoy as thoroughly is, I think, a greater influence on its leadership. Volunteers have an opportunity frequently to have a lot of input into who is the leader in the department, who serves in that leadership role. And I think that through that avenue alone, that the rank and file is probably much better positioned to try to put into interleadership roles those people that do have a culture of safety.
All right, thank you. Ron, do you have anything that you might want, with your experience out in Prince George's County as chief and now within NFFF?
Well, I think that Phil has touched on that. It is a significant issue that if the, as the question is, if the leadership of an organization is not setting the example or providing the opportunity for the general membership of the organization to follow, that if it's not important enough on their radar screen as the leadership, then it's definitely not going to be important enough on the firefighters. And just on the reverse side, though, I think also that, for example, in Prince George's, we have, you know, general orders and SOPs when I was there, and, you know, in a three-ring binder that would choke a horse. But if the crew that day decides that they're not going to follow those rules, they're not going to wear their seatbelts, or they're not going to stop at an intersection, then unfortunately the leadership has to deal with it, but it's after the fact. And so the question then becomes, how do we get everybody's attention that these occurrences are happening, and that oftentimes, you know, decisions that are made in a moment of time have a long-term effect on that crew, that department, and that community. And the way that the foundation is trying to address that is making, it goes to my original statement about, you know, we have firefighters who say, I know what I'm doing, I've been in this business a long time, I'm safe, even though they're not, or they may be taking excessive risks, is to bring in the reality that it can happen to them. And I think one of the great ways that is through real-life stories of survivors, members of families whose loved ones died in the line of duty, sometimes thinking that very issue, and also members of the fire service who've been down that road, who've traveled that journey, and are now able, through mediums and activities, to tell that story, and also such as reporting of near misses, so that people can see the reality of what's happening, and hopefully that information gets disseminated wide enough throughout the fire service that people say, you know what, that did happen to me, and I guess I was lucky that day, or that the consequences in that chain of events that lead to a firefighter fatality or significant disabling injury, one of those links just didn't hold up, and so therefore the incident did or didn't happen. But it's the reality check piece, I think, that is one of the ways that we've got to get both entities, the leadership of the organization, both formal and informal, to address this concern.
Well, I think I'm reminded of the phrase relentless persistence, and I think that's what it may take. We're talking about a bottom-up process, and, you know, there are several avenues for folks lower down in the chain of command, but I think just you got to keep pushing. It's too important to let it go. And I think also innovation has to play a role. There are physicians out there that will volunteer their time or negotiate a lower price for local firefighters to provide a physical. And as Chief DeBay said earlier, you know, it may not meet all of 1582, but, you know, if we can just get a EKG and a pulmonary function test done and some blood work, well, that's a quantum leap, especially for onboard firefighters, especially as they age. I want to throw it back to Susie for the next question.
Okay.
Hey, Glenn, can we just add something from the IFC on that last question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let me just show you. You know, it's normal to say, phew, like Ron said, we got away with it. So you get away with it, and either you learn from it or you don't. And that's kind of typical with bad behavior. When you make a mistake or you make an error, you either can say to yourself, I'm going to change, or you can say, wow, cool, I got away with it. Let's enjoy the risk. Let's enjoy the thrill of whatever that may be, that bad behavior. Just some thoughts to the person who sent that question. And one thing we don't really do as much as we should, we don't do enough face-to-face communication. You go back to the firehouse, you'll whine or complain about this or that, and you won't go to the office with the problem. Well, you can't approach them. Well, maybe you can. Maybe you go to your chief, whether it be career, volunteer, whoever it is, and bring them to the problem. If you're a volunteer fire department with an association, bring it up to the association meeting. Let them meet with the chief. If you're a union department, bring it to the union. Let the union meet with the chief with their concerns. And give examples to the chief of other fire departments where things have happened. You know, we use firefighterclosedcalls.com that Gord Graham and I run. We say the success of our website is like throwing mud. The more you throw, eventually it's going to stick. And that's why we continually, over and over and over, continue to post, continue to set out and send out and identify whether it's the same injury 1,000 times or a newer unique injury, we continue to send it out. Well, I think you can have success with a boss that way by making sure your boss sees. Just slip a copy of an article in the mailbox. Send him an email. Copy her an article of this happened and leave it under her door. Whatever it takes to get through to that person without being arbitrary. The next issue is whether it's an incident where a firefighter got hurt or killed. Maybe another article you may want to pass on to the chief is where a fire chief was held liable, where a fire chief ends up having to spend the next year or two worrying about his or her personal life as far as lawsuits or just the time that it's going to take when you get dragged into court. I mean, if a fire chief thinks they're busy now, and I don't know anybody who doesn't think they're busy these days, go ahead and have an attorney call you 6 months after a line-of-duty death and see how your life alters then. And then after that, if it just doesn't work, sometimes you have to work around the system. And I'm not advocating doing anything wrong or illegal. I'm saying, look, whether it's a grievance or whether it's taking official action, going to city council, it just depends on how serious the issue is and how bad the firefighters truly want to change it. But, you know, Glenn, it ties right back to what we said before. If you're not taking personal responsibility for your own safety and survival, which is the theme for this week, then it's not real fair to go tossing stones in other directions.
Agree on all points. As I said earlier, it's just too important. You know, if we can't support our employees or our members in terms of their health and fitness to perform the duties that we expect of them, then we're of little value to our organization. So we're going to throw it to Susie for the next question.
Okay, let's jump from that to seatbelts. And there are a few responses we have here, or questions actually, about use of seatbelts and how do we enforce them not only in the apparatus but personal vehicles responding to scenes or to the fire station.
We're going to ask Dr. Bert Clark to say a few words.
Thank you, Chief Gaines. This seatbelt certainly has been my cry for the last several years, along with lots of folks. And I do think it's a key factor in changing our complete safety culture, because fire trucks do have seat belts. Everybody knows how to put a seat belt on, so it's not a money issue, it's not an equipment issue, it's a decision issue. Will we decide to actually do it? And I think it's a multi-pronged kind of approach. Number one, each individual person that gets on a fire truck has to make that personal decision, yes, I'm going to put my seatbelt on no matter what. I want to congratulate the over 107,000 firefighters nationwide that have taken the National Fire Service seatbelt pledge. So if you wear your seatbelt, great. If you haven't taken the pledge, sign up. It sends a message to the rest of us that this is something we want to do. Our goal is to have 1 million signatures. Along the same lines, we have over 500 fire departments that have 100% of their personnel taking the seatbelt pledge. So they receive a very nice certificate indicating their 100% participation. Again, congratulations to those fire departments. As a matter of fact, just recently with the latest NIOSH line of duty death report, that was the vehicle accident up in New York, NIOSH is now recommending in one of their recommendations that the fire service take the National Fire Service Seatbelt Pledge. Each department receive 100% participation and receive their certificate. Along with that, NIOSH is also recommending that every state's seatbelt policy come in compliance with NFPA 1500. Today, unfortunately, they are not. Your state may have a seatbelt policy, but it may exempt the people in the back of the fire truck, or it may only require you to wear it on non-emergencies. So NIOSH has now said that every state law should be changed to meet 1500. At the same time, NIOSH is also recommending that the federal law under the National Motor Coach Regulation be amended to eliminate the exemption for firefighters wearing their seatbelts, and that the federal law also come in compliance with NFPA 1500. And lastly, just last week I was working with a fire department and the fire chief fired someone because someone got injured and the officer did not have all their personnel with a seatbelt on. So ultimately, all those things have to come together for us to solve this problem. What we want is to go a whole year with no firefighter killed in the line of duty because of lack of seatbelts. Unfortunately, we have not made that goal this year, but there's always next year. So thanks to everyone for working at it. Our job is not done yet. Please buckle up.
Hello, this is Glenn Gaines again. Anyone else want to chime in on this particular issue?
Chief Gaines, really just go ahead. This is Phil Stenberg. I just wanted to say that, you know, we're talking about two different things here, I think, actually, enforcement and training. And enforcement implies some sort of penalty if you don't comply. And there's certainly that opportunity out there, just as we enforce any other kind of rule. But it strikes me that the fire service is in a particularly good position to be able to demonstrate to our personnel the hazards of not wearing seat belts, because we respond day in and day out, 365 days a year, to motor vehicle accidents where people are injured, seriously injured, or killed that didn't have to be. And we can clearly see that seat belts would have reduced or prevented the injury. We have the perfect training tool right in front of us every day to show to our people and say, look, this is why we have a rule. We don't have to enforce the rule. We shouldn't have to enforce the rule, because you can see why the rule's important. You can see why you need to buckle up.
Thanks, Phil. Billy, was that you?
Yes, sir. Yeah, just a quick comment related to the seatbelt issue. If it's possible to wear seatbelts, then there's no excuse. There are some departments where the apparatus design, I know one department recently issued all their firefighters rope bags, and they have to wear the rope bag as a part of their gear. Well, now they can't fit in the seat with the seatbelt, so someone wasn't thinking. But obviously, in most cases, the apparatus, it's no problem. And basically, like UPS, if you don't wear your seatbelt, you lose your job. And we need to make it that serious, and whoever that chief was or other chiefs who have, they need to draw the line and make it real clear that, you know, I think Phil was talking about policy and training. Well, it really comes down to, not just for seatbelt, Glenn, but for many other aspects of this, develop a policy, train on the policy, force the policy, and take corrective action if the policy isn't followed. There's so many excuses on why we don't do this. I mean, there was a huge fire, I guess, over the weekend somewhere in an eastern state. Someone just sent our website a whole bunch of photos. There were two chief officers wearing shorts and T-shirts in the front of the house. I mean, in the doorway, and there was fire blowing out everywhere. So whoever said earlier about setting the example, well, basically what that chief has done has basically thrown the PPE policy out, you know, and you really do have to set the example, whether it be the physical issue or whether it be driving or seatbelts, like Phil was saying.
I agree. It has to be a reoccurring message in all aspects of training, in every policy, in the fire stations, in the bunk room, in the showers. The message has to be focused on health and safety if it's going to be adhered to and become part of the culture of the organization. We're going to do one more question, and then I want everyone to be ready to provide us with some closing comments. So, Susie, you're on.
Okay. I know, you know, the statistics show heart attacks, 50% line of duty deaths. What's being done across the board? Are your departments are about the mental health? I understand in some departments suicides are on the rise. Do you see this as a trend, terrible trend, and what's being done? Are there organizations looking at any kind of health for mental health issues?
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, that is one of the elements of the IFC, IFF Wellness Fitness. It was probably the toughest to get done because the mental health issues, it's kind of a moving target. It's so diverse, so difficult. It's very difficult to find, or it's challenging, I should say, to find healthcare professionals who can relate to specific firefighter needs. Some of the DOD folks can deal with some of the issues that firefighters face, but on a local level, it was really difficult. We were able to get it done before I left. I don't know how successful it was, but I want to ask Jim Brinkley, if you're still on, do you want to take a shot at that one?
Yeah. Behavior health has always been a tough component, just as Chief Gaines said in the initial development of the
IAFF and IAFC Wellness Fitness Initiative. It was a huge obstacle, probably one of the toughest components to implement. But in relation to the current obstacles and the spikes in suicide, which we are seeing, one of the things we're doing to address that is we're working with Susie Gulliver out of Texas A&M in a grant-funded study to determine what are the obstacles, what is the resistance from firefighters to seek the help that is out there. You know, typically when we encounter these suicides, all the individuals that were close to the deceased say that they did recognize signs, but no one came forward and said anything. Maybe it's because we feel that we're invulnerable, that we're above those stressors in life that everyone else faces. But as we all know in this line of work, we're more susceptible to those things. So we need to be cognizant of it and take proactive steps to not only reduce the stress initially, but when we see our members who are confronted with these problems, that we take action and speak up on their behalf. Listen, if they were in any danger of losing their life in a fire, we would all go to great lengths to save them. And we should go to the same great lengths when we see someone suffering from the stress of the job and any other behavioral health issues, which, quite frankly, with the economic crisis and everything that we're facing today, certainly we expect to see a spike in the fire service as much as the rest of the general population.
Glenn, if I could jump in there, this is Ron Sarnicky from the Fallen Firefighters Foundation. I just wanted to add that Jim is exactly correct, and the pieces covered in the IAFC, IAFF initiatives are right on target. In addition, there's a lot of study underway through the Department of Defense and the veteran support groups about some of these same issues that the military are facing. And there is a whole program related to psychological first aid that is being looked at as part of the resiliency model developed with all of those partners, IFF, IFC, the NFFF, and others who assisted during 9/11, and then also did the same program components in Charleston with the Charleston 9 firefighter fatalities. And through Fire Act Grant, and the importance of that, the foundation has been working with all of those partners, the national organizations as well, the IFF, NVFC, and IFC, to put together some toolboxes on this very subject. So we've had a series of, I guess you could say, mini summits related to that, and it's a peer-based model that has a clinical support mechanism to it as well. And we hope with additional support, and this isn't a plug for our grant application, I'm sure everybody can appreciate that, but it's to take it to the next level as we go through that process. But we're looking to have some toolbox items for the different levels of the fire service community out within the next year or so related to these studies that are underway. And there's some great stuff that the military has done that we can really adapt to the fire service community. So that's a critical piece. It's Initiative 13 of the 16 initiatives, and then having psychological support available to the fire service and their families.
Thanks, Ron. Good thoughts. Just one quick thing from my desk. We learned the hard way that you've got to bring the peers in. That'll eliminate some of the resistance. So what you do is you use the peer approach in that you train peer members, mostly in awareness, and to dispel this whole issue of viewed as a weakness. To seek help, and we experienced some measurement of, effectiveness, but I'll have to say one of the last things, unfortunate circumstances I had to deal with, it was a fatality, a self-inflicted wound by a firefighter that we missed. So it's not perfect, but I think anything you can do in terms of recognition, awareness, and bringing in the peers, I think is vital, as was witnessed by the Wellness Fitness Initiative in terms of getting people fit and eating properly. All right, we're going to do summary statements. Everybody's going to have about a minute because we are pushed for time. If you can keep it within a minute, I would appreciate it. Bill Troop is our first speaker. Bill.
Thank you, Chief Gaines. I'd just like to emphasize for our fire service audience that the U.S. Fire Administration has a myriad of training, education, and research programs in firefighter health and safety. Please visit our website at www.usfa.dhs.gov to find the programs that we put together to help you. Thank you, Chief Gaines.
Excellent. He actually, he may be deferring some of his time to Dr. Clark here. That was 45 seconds.
Thanks, Chief Gaines. Just to remind everyone, you can go to the National Fire Service Seatbelt Pledge homepage, which is www.trainingdivision.com/seatbeltpledge.asp. There are a lot of materials and resources there that can help you with your seatbelt campaign. Also, tomorrow, one of the lead stories is going to be seatbelt LODDs remembered. There's two stories about two of our fallen brothers there, so hopefully use that during your stand town time. And finally, just another footnote about the health issue. A year or so ago, I did a radio at firehouse.com podcast on depression in the fire service. So there were actually some case studies of firefighters that have been going through that. Plus, we had the Montgomery County, Maryland health professionals on with us, and they have a great toolbox, and the references are right there on site. So anyone that's interested, please feel free to go there and get information. Again, I want to thank U.S. Fire Administration and all those on the line for doing this. Buckle up, everybody.
Good words. Okay, Jim Brick.
Yeah, you know, during this conversation, we've talked quite a bit about leadership and bottom-up and all the programs that are out there. I think as leaders in the fire service, we need to take the first step. We got to stop looking at the least common denominator and going down to the firefighter and disciplining that firefighter for not following rules, orders, and procedures. I'm not saying that they don't have to follow them, but as leaders, we need to take the proactive step. Stop eliminating the prevention programs, the safety programs, and the training programs. Stop taking the easy way out. The Wellness Fitness Initiative has been shown to save money. It is cost effective. And we need to make sure that every firefighter, regardless of their affiliation, gets an entry-level physical and an annual medical physical so that we can send these folks home to their families healthy and as safe as they were when they arrived on the job.
Excellent, Jim. Phil?
One word I've heard repeated several times today is the word culture. And, excuse me, the question has been continually asked, how do we change a culture, or how do we create a safety culture? And I think the answer is we changed it, and we accomplished it exactly like we are right now, by getting information out. Information today is more available than ever before. It moves faster than ever before. Websites are available. Podcasts are available. There are any number of information sources out there. Ignorance is no longer an excuse at any level, from the firefighter level right to the chief officer level. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Good words. Chief Dubé.
Thanks, Chief. I'd just like to say all of this change is going to come back to leadership. And what I mean about that is leadership at all levels of the department, starting with the firefighters and the unit officers who are willing to step into the arena of culture change and take the beat down that they're going to get from their peers, but stand up and make a difference. Stand up and do the right thing. Don't pull out of the firehouse if everybody's not buckled in. Don't go to Pizza Hut every day for lunch and talk to your chief every day about getting the annual physical that's necessary to keep you alive and well.
Thanks, Chief. Billy?
Really talking about a culture of survival. And you know, the everyone goes home and got together and came up with that, and it has had an impact, but not everyone goes home. And there's really two columns in that area of not everyone going home. There's the few firefighters each year that, quite frankly, had to give their lives for very valid situations. The Howie Carplucks in New York City, the Kevin Apuzios in New Jersey, the ones where everything was done right, but yet they did have to lose their lives. And we can't just, you know, we can't say, and we haven't, of course, that any line of duty death is unnecessary, because occasionally there are. What we're focused on is the other column of not everyone going home. And those are the ones that were so unnecessary. The ones who were operating at a building for 4 hours and then it collapsed during overhaul and took firefighters out. the ones that haven't trained, the one that had the heart attack, the one that didn't wear the seatbelt, as Dr. Clark was talking about. That's really where our focus is. There's been almost an interesting development within safety of that safety nonsense and all that. That's not what we're talking about. In some cases, you do have to risk your life. The point is, if you love being a firefighter so much and you love your family and love all the other good stuff you're doing, why wouldn't you want to take the appropriate steps to minimize the risk? And so if you do have to take a risk, you have that much more of a chance of surviving. Quick comment, if any of you are interested in getting some hands-on involvement within this at a national level, you can get involved with the National Fallen Firefighters Advocacy Program. You can also join the IFC and as an associate member, and we'll get you involved at the IFC Safety, Health, and Survival section. Chief Gaines, thanks to you, Bill Troop, Al, Tom, Dr. Clark, and the rest of you for hosting this today, and certainly Firehouse.com.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I want to thank Susie here, who has been busily capturing all the good words and the information that's been sent our way, and I want to first thank all of our participants, both here at USFA, for those on the teleconference, and for you out there in the virtual world who have tuned in. I would remind everyone that you can catch this roundtable later on today on a podcast, and I want to end by bringing Ron Sarnecki on to say some final words, and then we'll close.
And also, I want to thank everyone who participated today and made it happen, because we need to continue to just be out there telling the story, pushing the programs, and making sure that people demonstrate what it takes when we talk about the courage to be safe. And I do believe that the 16 life safety initiatives, which the fire service community got together and in unity created, is the blueprint that we should follow in a variety of things. Granted, not every initiative applies to every aspect of the fire service. They cover a broad spectrum of things, for the rank and file firefighters, to leadership, to the National Fire Service community. But I think that if you dig deep into them, you will find something that fits into your organization. And I think that's what we're talking about, demonstrating the leadership, whether you're the formal leader or the informal leader, to influence those around you to make a difference in the survivability of yourself and your crew. And that's what we're talking about today. And I think that comes through training, education, commitment, and resources. And all those factors fall on the various aspects of the fire service organizational structure. So it's out there. It's available. It's there. We just have to be persistent, as you said, Glenn, and continue to push this across the country.
Thanks, Ron. Good words. Wanted to ask Susie first for some closing remarks, but also to remind us when the podcast might be available to our listeners.
First of all, appreciate USFA, joining, partnering with Firehouse.com for this roundtable. Commitment, Firehouse.com, on safety, and keep making sure everyone does go home after their shift, whether it be in an ambulance, fire truck, wherever. Also, later this afternoon, maybe around 5 o'clock time frame, if you go to Firehouse, RadioFirehouse.com, you'll find the link to this podcast. That's RadioFirehouse.com. And appreciate the cooperation with you, Chief Gaines, and the participants for making this a reality this afternoon.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for dialing in. And we will be signing off. Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.